Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Bulante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Derek Berry, author of Heathens and Liars of Lickskillet County, a remarkable first novel by this young author, which explores life in a small town in Lickskillet County, South Carolina, a murder mystery, and the all-controversial racial topic in the South. A fantastic, well-written story with unexpected twists and characters. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Derek. Derek Berry is a novelist, spoken word poet, and student. He has published Heathens and Liars of Lickskillet County with PRA Publishing in 2016. This is his first novel. He performs spoken word in venues across the Southeast United States and hosts bi-monthly poetry series, The Unspoken Word in Charleston, South Carolina. He is currently studying as an undergraduate in political science and international studies at the College of Charleston. For more information on Derek Berry and his book, visit his website at www.derekberry.wordpress.com, and that is DerekBerry.wordpress.com. Hi, Derek. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm doing really swell.
Thank you so much for being with us. I'm really excited to talk to you because it's very rare that I get to talk to such a young published author. So I'm really grateful that you took time out of your college schedule and all that stuff to talk to an old lady here. Please tell listeners a little bit about yourself and what was your upbringing and, you know, while growing up in the South.
Well, I grew up in Aiken, South Carolina, which has a population of about 30,000 people. So it's not a small southern town, but it's also not a city. And I lived a little bit outside of the city limits, which gave me kind of a taste of rural life without really being entrenched in farm life or hunting or things like that. And my father's side of the family is very southern. So, you know, I grew up on sweet tea, pretty much runs through my blood at this point. And, you know, kind of surrounded a lot by hunting culture, southern culture, and things of that nature. And that really shaped kind of my experiences becoming a writer.
Yeah, and I must tell you, I've been in South Carolina, and I lived in North Carolina for a while. So I can testify to the southern charm of the South over there because I really loved it. You are so young. I saw your picture. I don't know your age, but you really look young. And it's very seldom that you see somebody not only publish a book but get raving reviews from it at your age. When and how did you start writing? Because you must have started at a very early age.
Yes, I was a very ambitious child. When I was 11, I remember sitting at the family computer for hours on end, and I remember writing my first book and thinking, okay, I'm going to be published by 13. That was my goal. And then I said, okay, maybe by 16. And now I'm 22 and my first book is published. So, it's a little bit behind schedule, but, you know, things are going well. I was writing constantly as a kid. Actually, when I was around 11, my parents told me, look, we're just going to have to buy him a laptop, you know, because he'll spend hours and hours on the family computer, and I'd print off stories in 24-point font for no particular reason other than to make it look as if I'm writing even more than I was and force people to read it. So it was really lovely growing up. I think I had a grand delusion about how to write and what it meant to be a writer,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, that delusion was incredibly beneficial because I was writing about a manuscript-length story every year or so, maybe 2 years for some of them. So by the time I was 16, I had already, you know, written hundreds of thousands of words. I had a lot of story under my belt, and I kind of learned through kind of mimicking others. I remember writing a bunch of really silly books that were basically knockoffs of other books.
How did you get inspired at that age, though? Did you have, like, a storyteller relative, or you were just born with this storytelling talent?
Well, when I was really young, my mom used to read to us. So I have two brothers, and we kind of had like bedtime story. But she didn't really like reading children's books. So we'd read stuff that was meant for young adults, a little bit older, you know, which is maybe
awesome.
9 or 10. But I was really into that, and our house was full of books, just wall to wall, books, books, books. So, of course, I grew up reading constantly.
That's awesome. You know, I checked out your blog, and I can see where your talent comes very, you have your own voice, which is rare for somebody so young to accomplish, and I can see that you have written even probably more than what I had at the time that I published my book. Writing a fiction book length not only takes creativity and talent and inspiration, it takes a lot of discipline. So why don't you talk to us a little bit of how you came up with that perfect balance of creativity and discipline and inspiration?
Well, when I was in high school, which is when I first started writing this book, Heathens and Liars, it was rather easy. I felt kind of unchallenged by school, which now is completely untrue. But I remember being very bored. You know, in class, I'd finished my work early, so I was constantly scribbling things. I'd bring my laptop to class, and I'd just kind of be writing. I also was a lot better at writing habits when I was younger. I've started to slack off because of the things I must do at university, all of the kind of endless course load. So I had, like, really good writing habits. I'd wake up around 6 in the morning and write for about 2 hours before school. And having that kind of habit of writing every day was really beneficial because, you know, like I said, I really was under the impression, okay, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a writer. So I tried to work like I was already a published professional writer and made it a part of my schedule.
Did you write at the high school paper or anything like that? Did you get that opportunities like that, or you were just immersed in your own writing?
I did. When I was a sophomore, I started writing for the high school newspaper, and it really helped me develop a voice that was a lot funnier. I think it was very morose at first when I was writing, and then I began, probably when I was a junior in high school, writing a humor column for the high school newspaper, which is called the Hornet Herald, and that humor column helped me develop my voice.
That's awesome. I wish that we would have had a paper in high school. I used to write since a very young age, also around maybe 12 years old.
Yeah.
I had my diary and stuff. But during high school, I had no outlet. So it makes all the difference when you do, because then you give it that serious attitude to your writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that discipline that you learned and your habits help you balance your college student schedule with your new published book promotion and writing.
Somewhat, yeah. Right now, it's been absolutely insane. So for the past 2 weekends, and then I had 1 weekend off, and the weekend before that, I've just been doing book tour dates. So
mm-hmm.
I've been doing readings, all through South Carolina. The book came out in February, and it's been nonstop since then. And it's also my very last semester as a student at the College of Charleston,
mm-hmm.
which has been a very challenging. This week is actually finals week. So
oh,
I'm 2
wow.
days away from being done. So it's just kind of sleeplessness. I haven't worked on the book or the second book in about like 2 or 3 weeks because I've just been kind of inundated with essays and senior thesis.
Yeah. Derek, tell me something. I mean, you're majoring in political science, I saw, and that's actually my major. I have a BA in political science and business administration. So I told you we had something in common. And not only that, my daughter also is got a BA in science, and she's working with refugees. So she's been working with refugees for a while when she was in Colorado. So tell me a little bit about your experience in the international politics and refugee policy, because I think it's so interesting, and I'm really happy to talk to a peer or soon-to-be peer.
Most of my work so far has been theoretical, based
mm-hmm.
in college. So I started my senior thesis on migration policy in Germany, and I was particularly interested in how integration works for migrants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking at the history of Turkish guest workers in Germany who started coming over in the 1960s, West Germany, during a kind of labor shortage. But now, as refugees from Syria and other countries have been entering Europe, and Germany is kind of becoming the country that's leading the EU through that refugee crisis, I think it's really important to look back on the past about the importance of integration and where Germany and other countries have stumbled and where they've succeeded, and then try to apply those lessons to what's going on right now, particularly in Germany.
You know, with everything that we hear in the news of the immigrants here in the U.S., immigrants mm-hmm. policy, do you think that it resembles a little bit of what's going on in Europe, in Germany, or are we all doing different things, do you think?
I definitely think there's similarities one can draw between the corridor of migration from Central America, Mexico into the U.S., as well as from North Africa, Middle East into Europe, because a lot of the people coming specifically from Central America and Mexico are fleeing war, just not war in the same sense as the Syrian war. So, I mean, the drug war in Mexico has caused massive violence, and I think that, you know, that those kinds of conditions make it necessary to leave. So I definitely think that there are similarities to be drawn. And also the rhetoric, this very angry rhetoric about migrants and about refugees that paints them as less than people but more as these kind of political objects who have to be dealt with, I think is really harmful. And I think that kind of applies both, especially for Latino migrants in the United States and also the migrants who are from different Muslim-majority countries in who are coming into Europe.
Your book, Heathens and Liars at Lickskillet County, tells a story based also on a hate crime. Was all this contact that you're having with refugees in your studies inspire the kind of the main plot and the way that you developed the story? I know you were writing it in high school. Did it influence at all when the plot that you did in this book?
No, just because my kind of interest in migration policy came a lot later.
Mm-hmm.
I think my politics have become a lot more radical, especially kind of concerning borders and what borders signify and what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of all developed while I was in university.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely kind of things going on in my like hometown as well as around the United States when I was growing up definitely influenced the way in which I viewed racism. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's really strange because after it came out, there's been an increase in visibility of racially motivated crimes,
mm-hmm.
especially with kind of more, I guess, a new focus on police brutality and police deaths of black women and men in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not something, I mean, I planned or was thinking about when I was writing the book. I was actually thinking a lot more about what had happened to all of these kind of white supremacist groups, because until recently, I don't think, you know, we really, like, heard about them a lot, and I started being interested in, like, okay, well, you know, what does it look like to be a modern-day, you know, member of the Ku Klux Klan? What does it mean to be a modern-day white supremacist? And it's really bizarre because they've kind of changed their image in a really radical and kind of tricky way that is now being reflected in American politics in a very particular way. So instead of being explicitly racist or explicitly anti-black or anti-migrant, they frame the rhetoric around being pro-family or pro-American values or drawing from Christian values while actually using that kind of mechanism of justification to then enact actually really, really racist policies.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specialized in interviewing published authors about their current books and their areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download from your computer for your convenience. Please visit us at InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Derek Berry, author of Heathens and Liars of Liskillet County. Stay tuned because we are going to continue this fun, entertaining, and enlightening conversation with Derek about balancing his author life with being a student. Discipline, creativity and inspiration, politics and refugees, and racial issues, among other topics. But in the meantime, you can check out Heathens and Liars of Liskillet County and his blog by visiting his website at www.derekberry.wordpress.com, and that is DerekBerry.wordpress.com.
One of the things I remember kind of grappling with in the book, especially in studies afterwards, is when we think about racism, we typically think about, you know, we think about white hoods, we think about burning crosses, we think about these really explicit expressions of racism. But sometimes the most harmful forms of racism come through institutional frameworks. So the way schools are created, the way communities have been restructured so that certain people have a political voice and certain people do not, the way in which jobs are offered to some people and not offered to other people based on race, things like that come from people who are in power, so people who aren't explicitly racist but rather claim that they don't really think about race or, oh, but at the same time, they are, because they're in power, they're using that authority to then push across these kind of racist agendas.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I spent a year in Boone, North Carolina, in the Appalachian State University, and I remember I was 17, actually, because I graduated from high school at a very early age. Me and my brother did so. And I remember people that we knew in Florida told my parents, oh, no, you know, she's going to have a hard time. And I actually found it opposite. I was actually everybody's pet. So everybody just was very warm. I didn't have any trouble whatsoever. And the only time I had maybe a little bit of problem was during a math class, and my professor handled it very well. So do you think it is because some people, it's the lack of contact with different cultures that might kind of make all this, I don't want to say hate against races, but, you know, racism, do you think has to do it with being just always in a bubble and not going out? Because I find, I didn't grow in a bubble. My parents were immigrants in Venezuela. They were from Italy. So I've been an immigrant all my life, and then I migrated here. And my children are first-generation Americans, but they are, my daughter, one is brown hair and hazel eyes. The other one is blonde and blue eyes. So my family has all kinds of colors because of occupation in Europe was many different races, right? So yeah. I really didn't understand it. So I wonder, what do you think racism occurs? Whether on the South, well, in your experience, I'm not asking for a, you know, like a theory, you know, like a thesis on it, but I want to know what somebody from the South thinks. Why does it occur in the South?
Oh man, that's a very good question. I'll try to like touch upon some of it. I mean, it's something that I feel on one hand a little bit uncomfortable talking about. I think that's one of the reasons it's difficult. As a white man, I think it's really difficult to then make claims about the experiences of people who are not myself and don't share that particular experience, because I do think there is a difference in experience. And a lot of it, I mean, obviously it stems from the history of racial prejudice in the United States, beginning with the way in which, like, hierarchies were institutionalized through slavery. And then, you know, after the abolition of slavery, there were still really conscious and deliberate efforts to just dismantle and dispower black communities. So the Jim Crow laws, but also, I mean, smaller mechanisms were kind of put in place So on one hand, you know, you want to talk, like, I hear a lot of people, I live in Charleston, South Carolina. So for the past year, I've heard a lot of talk about this, you know, about harmony and the need to come together. And, okay, if you're friends with different people, a diverse set of people, then you can kind of understand racism. But on the other hand, it has to do with both the personal level but also the institutional level. Mm-hmm. So I think just people, I think that's a very important part of it, and I think that's kind of where a lot of the ground-level work dismantling white supremacist systems comes in, is in people just living in a really, like, love ethic toward each other and mm-hmm. truly, like, becoming friends and getting to know people as people and not these really harmful narratives and stereotypes. But on the other hand, it really also takes the people in power, the people with authority, to make decisions, to make right the historical disenfranchisement of people of color in the United States.
Yeah, I actually really agree with you, and this is why I brought this question. We are living in Venezuela's situation. When I was living there, there was very little racism. And then one person comes into power, and now you see how the color of your skin does make a difference for the worse for the light-skinned colored people because of Chavez. And so you're right, institutionalized racism can really make a difference in a country, whether for the better or for the worse. And,
right.
Yeah, so history has a lot to say, but also by changing the philosophy and policy and institution, you can restructure everything and change history. Yeah, so very well said. I'm very impressed by your answer.
I think it's really important to just have, like, honest dialogue about it too. A lot of people want to pretend like we're in this post-racial age, you know, Barack Obama's president, our first black president, as if we somehow transcended race and somehow moved past all of these issues. And by ignoring that, by pretending to be colorblind, I think we only reinforce the systems that are in place.
Yeah. Listeners, we've been talking to Derek Berry, author of Heathens and Liars of Lickskillet County, which is actually raving in between our reviewers here and Reader Views as well as others. And I really recommend this book for you to check out. Our reviewer, Sherry, gave it a really big praise, and she says she loved the characters and your writing. Please check it out at derekberry.wordpress.com, and that is D-E-R-E-K. BERRY.wordpress.com. Derek, are you working on a sequel for it?
I'm not working on a sequel, but I am working on book number two.
Okay, what is it about?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit. It's about a black girl in Charleston who has come out as gay to her father and kind of about the fallout of that as she's navigating college life.
Oh, wow. I love it that your main character is a girl.
Yeah.
Are you ready to do that? Where are you doing your research?
Well, I'm definitely wanting to challenge myself. I live with these two black girls, so I'm having them read it as well to make sure I'm not saying anything super offensive or totally wrong.
That's awesome. You also work as a spoken word poet. So what do you do as a spoken word poet?
Well, so a spoken word poet is just like a poet, except that there's an emphasis on performance of the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So I write the poems, edit them, memorize them, and then perform them as features at different open mics, poetry slams, and showcases kind of around the Southeast.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. How do you stumble into that? Is that like a trend right now? Or I've never heard of a spoken word poet. I mean, I've always heard the term poet. I write poetry myself, and I have gone to open mics myself, but I never really listened to somebody call themselves a spoken word poet. So how do you stumble upon that?
It's definitely rising in popularity right now with an emphasis on poetry slams, which is a competitive form of a poetry show where you get points and go through different rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I stumbled onto it when I was about 16. I remember I really thought poetry was boring and stupid, and I was a big snob. I'm like, oh, you know, Robert Frost, you know, I don't care what road he's taking in the woods. I really don't care. But then I remember walking into a room and someone was just speaking this poem and performing it from memory and doing it with such passion. I remember looking at that person and saying, okay, I'm going to do that. That looks so amazing. So I started writing and going to open mics. And now that I've moved to Charleston, I started my own poetry series, which has open mics and slams. We just had a showcase last night where we had a book release party for a good friend of mine in Charleston named Marcus Amaker. And it's just been really wonderful because it's grown tremendously. We get about 50 to 100 people at every show. And people are just really loving it. And I think it's a way to really bring poetry into the community because people see poetry as something that is like dying or dead. But I mean, obviously poetry has been dying a very long time. You know, people have been saying, oh, poetry's dead. Poetry. And I'm like, okay, well, it's still alive and we're still here and we're still speaking.
Yeah, well said. We're getting towards the end. And again, we're talking to Derek Berry, author of Heathens and Liars of Lickskillet County. His website, derekberry.wordpress.com. I checked out your blog, and I think you have a wonderful voice there. And you called what's the name of your blog, by the way?
It's Word Salad.
Salad, exactly. I thought that was hilarious and so true when you described it. You just put the words with no meaning whatsoever, and you put in, you know, Wikipedia. And I thought that was hilarious. Where did you come up with that name?
Oh, Word Salad?
Mm-hmm.
Word Salad is actually a term in psychology. It's also sometimes called schizophrenia. I think it also has another name. I can't remember off the top of my head. But it is when a particular part of your brain is acting up, so you begin speaking these kind of mixtures of random and unintelligible words and phrases mm-hmm. that seem not to have any connectivity between them. So, I don't know, I just really liked the phrase word salad, and I thought it kind of described my, well, it doesn't describe my thought process, but it kind of speaks to the way in which my mind works and it's kind of going off in a thousand different directions.
Well, Derek, it's actually really been really nice talking to you because you're very wise for your age and you're very accomplished for your age, and at the same time you sound very down to earth and just plain old nice. So I'm glad that we got to talk, and I want to ask you, what would you tell yourself now that you've gone through the entire process of writing a full book and publishing it, and you're in the promoting, and now you know what a published author is all about? What would you tell your old self before you even thought about publishing?
I would say, don't take yourself too seriously. Don't get a big head. Make sure to remember, hey, everything you're going to do is still to be done, and that it's going to be a slow and hard process. It's going to be incredible, but it's going to be a very long process. So you got to just keep humble, I think, is the really important thing.
That's awesome and very well said. I agree with you. I was very humbled by my process. My process for my first book was 16 years. So you can imagine that because I had to learn English before I could really publish in English. So be proud of yourself. You know, not everyone has the discipline and the persistence to finish a project like yours. So very well done. Thank you for being here. Listeners, again, we've been talking to Derek Berry, and his book is Heathens and Liars of Lickskillet County. Check it out at derekberry.wordpress.com, and that is derekberry.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for being here, Derek, and very much luck with your future book as well.
Thank you very much. It was really lovely talking to you.
And listeners, thank you again for being with us, and until next time.